evident that I'm not Nima. I only realised I might be expected to do this about an hour and a half ago. So what I've done here is I haven't actually really talked about this subject in a lecture for sort of 10, 12 or more years. And so what I've done is I found some old slides from some general talk, and I hope I can make them relevant to a modern audience. So this is a story which developed through the 80s and 90s, largely started by Richard Ward and Nigel Hitchin, and developed by myself and Nick Woodhouse and lots of other friends. And the work, as far as I was concerned, or myself and Nick Woodhouse, led to this book, published 15 years ago now. So as you can see, it's a relatively old subject. And whilst this talk will be about the relationship between twister theory and integrability, one of the things that makes me feel slightly nervous with this audience is that this is very much classical integrability, and I think everyone here is interested in quantum integrability. And it remains a challenge to really quantize the ideas that I'm going to be talking about. So, maybe after this, some of you will be able to help me with this, or help us do that. So, just some general. Sorry, I can hardly see. Okay, so some general comments then. So, how might a relationship between twister theory and integrability come about? I mean, twister theory itself started life in the 60s. As a program set up by Roger Penrose for really reformulating all of physics in a way that's independent of space-time. And many of you will have heard people talk about quantum gravity and how difficult it is to even talk about space-time when you want to quantize it, and how you should perhaps express it as a theory on a different space. And so Roger Penrose discovered twister space as an alternative arena, and proposed that might be the space on which physics is most naturally expressed. But in order to do so, we've got to actually sort of reformulate standard physics on twister space, and so this led to a sort of a challenge just to take the ordinary equations of mathematical physics, Yang-Mills and Einstein equations, and reformulate them in some way on this twister space. Now, twister space, just to give you some idea, is complex projective three space. So you imagine you've got four homogeneous coordinates, and we quotient out by the complex scaling, and that gives you what's known as complex projective three space. So that is what twister space is. It's a complex manifold. It has three complex dimensions. And so the natural way to express objects of interest are going to be in terms of complex objects. And idea was to express Yang-Mills and Einstein equations somehow as deformations of complex structures on objects on twister space. The, so I've said the stuff about quantum gravity. Now, of course, this was a hard thing to do, and in fact, it's really only in the last 8 years since Witten's twister string theory that we've been able to say anything about a full physical theory like Yang-Mills. And the subject was essentially, before twister string theory, was essentially stuck for a quarter of a century. So there had been this amazing breakthrough in 1978 from Richard Ward, which had a precursor in work of Roger Penrose's. So Richard Ward, Penrose's original construction was to show that the Einstein equations could be expressed in terms of deformations of the complex structure actually on twister space itself. So you take a region CP3, you can somehow deform its complex structure. I don't want to say too much about what that means in detail, but you deform the complex structure, and that encodes the precise degrees of freedom of a gravitational field, and if you impose some extra geometric conditions, you can make it Einstein. Richard Ward did the same thing for Yang Mills. So up here I've said that we're looking at deformed almost complex structures on twister space. The word almost is something that's really cropped up in the last 6 years. If you're just interested in the self-duality equations, you find you've actually got deformed honest complex structures on twister space. And So what was observed was that this was tantamount to a complete solution to the self-Yang-Mills equations. So what happened is that the self-Yang-Mills equations are now well known to be an integrable system of equations, just in the sense of classical differential equations. But at the time, that wasn't the case. And Richard Ward showed that the general solution of the Yang-Mills equation could be expressed as, in terms of holomorphic data on twister space, it was freely prescribable. You just write down an arbitrary holomorphic function, that gives you the general solution to the self-Yang-Mills equation, just in a very local sense. And this was used by Atiyah, Drinfeld, Hitchin, and Manman to spectacular success in the construction of instantons from the algebraic geometry of vector bundles on all of CP3. And so this gave a paradigm for what you might mean by complete integrability of a system of equations. You've got this highly non-trivial transform. The relationship between twister space and space-time is non-local. So you have a highly non-trivial transform, but if you can implement that transform, then you have solved the equations because the data on twister space is free. And it turns out that you can do so by solving only linear equations in some generalized sense. So, I mean, these equations are not necessarily easy to solve, but you can do it in many examples and proof theorems in general. Anyway, so while we are waiting for things like twister string theory and such like to come along, twister theorists had to have something to do, and so many of us turned to sort of more mathematical exercises. And the one that I turned to was studying integrable systems. And this is prompted by ideas of Richard Ward and Nigel Hitchens, as I was saying. So the the point is that the twister construction provides a paradigm for complete integrability of a system of equations. And so maybe you could develop a whole point of view on integrable equations coming from the self-duality equations and coming from the twister construction as the basic tool. And this led to a program which had two parts. One of them was, in some sense, purely botanic. You can classify all those integral systems that arise as symmetry reductions of the self-duality equations, and then you can hope to actually solve those equations in an interesting way using twister methods, or at least understand how it is that other people have been doing so. So this was the program that Richard Ward and, that Nick Woodhouse and I sort of wrote about in this book. Now, to an audience like this, as I said, these are old slides from some talk from 12 years ago, and it was to an audience who didn't know anything about integrability, but everyone here will perhaps be aware of the Louis Armstrong comment about jazz. What is an integrable system? Well, if you've got to ask, you'll never know. It's a Louis Armstrong comment. So here are some definitions, but these are probably not the ones that you are actually keen on or familiar with. I mean, this is a Hamiltonian system with constant motion involution, the corresponding transform to action angle variables. The one that's most relevant to us here is the definition, which is the one that most people who work, at least with classical integrable equations, use, which is that you have to have a lax pair. You have to be able to express the nonlinear equations as a consistency condition for an overdetermined set of linear equations, so a lax pair. And that leads to all the tools that people use. So, and I guess in the quantum approach, then the it may be that what one thinks about something like the R matrix as being the quantum analog. But okay, so the in terms of the actual properties of the solutions to the equations, I mean, what can you do with the lax pair? Well, there are two different things that people tend to be very interested in. There's the construction of soliton-like solutions. So typically, these are lump-type solutions which don't interact as much as you'd expect. You know, they maintain their integrity as they pass through each other, and they can, there might be some phase shifts or something, but they maintain their interaction. They maintain their integrity under collisions. So the inverse scattering transform is more a statement about general solutions. You can decompose the general solution into somehow a bunch of solitons and some dispersive data. And this is the field theory, a classical field theoretic version of this transform to action angle variables where the flow is linear. So, so as you can see, this is very different from the sorts of things that I've seen you people talking about here, but of course this is a classical differential equations rather than quantum. Now this slide on the Self-Guyon-Mills equation is probably not so helpful for a mathematical physicist who would be happy with the use of spinor notation. So the so you have a connection on a bundle over space-time, and here I'm using the coordinates, null coordinates on space-time, or double null coordinates on space-time. So the x naught, x1 are going to be complex in general. And the lax pair as given there, if you're happy with, so I tend to use the Penrosian notation where the A, the spinor indices given by capital Roman letters, and so the so your connection could be so if this is d by dx a prime, the connection might be given by an object of that form, and then the lax pair would be a pair of vector fields that depend on, in the way that I'm writing it, two auxiliary complex parameters in the form of a spinor, pi a prime. And then the condition that this is integrable turns out to be just a statement about the curvature of the connection. In fact, this is going to be so if the curvature has a spinor form, FAA prime BB prime equals epsilon AB FA prime B prime plus epsilon A prime B prime FAB, then this would be pi A prime pi B prime FA prime B prime. And this here is the self-dual part of the curvature. Well, maybe I'll change my convention to call that the anti-self-dual part of the curvature. And so the integrability condition here, so this equals zero if and only if the anti-self-dual Yang-Mills equations are satisfied. Sorry, connection is self-dual. Okay, so that's the maybe more familiar way of seeing the lax pair for the Self-Guyon-Mills equations. Anyway, so these equations are not so they admit real solutions only on real slices of complex Minkowski space, which are signature 2-2 or Euclidean. So they don't admit solutions in Lorentzian signature, but they've The equations are themselves conformally invariant, like the full Yang-Mills equations, and the principal application to mathematical physics has been studying the instanton solutions, which are those solutions which are global on Euclidean R4, that actually extend to the four-sphere, S4. Okay, so this is our principal example of an integral system, but of course for most people in the integral systems differential equations community, the most interesting examples as far as they were concerned were the Korsvog de Vries equation and also the Kadontsev-Petviashvili equations, maybe in higher dimensions. So the KdV equations also, so this is just a function of two variables. This is a water wave equation, but of course it's had prominence in mathematical physics through the relationship with Gromov-Witten theory and as a generating function for the tau functions tend to be partition functions for certain topological string theories and so on. The anyway, so this has a Lax pair, which is actually the way that I've written this, you've also got two operators whose commutation gives rise to the to the Korsvog de Vries equation, and one of the results that I'm going to be talking about is the fact that you can obtain this Korsvog de Vries equation as a symmetry reduction of the self-dual Yang-Mills equations, and maybe one can already see that partially from this way of writing the Lax pair, where you can actually see that the it has a similar structure to that of the self-dual Yang-Mills equation, so it's not so hard to imagine that you can reduce one to the other. Yeah.
Does this twist or construction fit in the other framework?
Well, no. So the I guess I was really going to be talking about these two systems as to distinguish them. So here, I mean, the KP equations, of course, has many reductions. One where, for example, you have an nth order analog of the Schrödinger equation as part of the Lax system. So I guess the point here is that the structure of the Lax pair for the KP equation is that of a rather more complicated differential operator. And so I was going to say sort of a bit later that, that the Lax pair here can't be embedded in the Yang-Mills Lax pair in a finite format, a finite dimensional gauge group.
Yeah, but so the point is that just if you cancel in the last row, L0, you cancel the derivative with respect to Y, you have, no, the very bottom of your transparency, L0, the first Lax pair, you cancel Y,
right.
No dependence on Y, then you get the formulation I was talking on.
That's
for
correct.
All the KdV. So
that's
how
right.
Does it fit in the twister description? That was my question.
Yeah, so the KP equation doesn't fit into it in a finite dimensional context. You have to go to some infinite dimensional framework. Sorry, no. If you kill the Y, then this is just this. With if you you can reduce this to, I mean, there's always, yeah. If you kill the Y, then you can always reduce a second order equation to a first order system, and that's what we've done here. So this L naught here is the same as that L naught if you kill the DWY. You have to kill. Yeah, you kill the Y by introducing a spectral parameter. So you somehow imagine you've got an e to the lambda Y in the as a coefficient in the solution to the Lax system. So, yeah. Well, so the point here then is that going from KP to KdV required you to express this as a rank 2 system, if you want to get all the Gelfand-Dickey ones, you have to go up to rank N. Or the Drinfeld-Sokolov, sorry. If you want to have the Drinfeld-Sokolov ones, you have to go up to rank N. I mean, they're based on nth order reductions. Or rank of gauge group. This is really just ordinary Yang-Mills at this stage. But it's the rank of the gauge group. Yeah. Okay, so these are two classical examples of integrable systems. And the good news is, yeah, so the... as you're just saying, the KP reduces to KdV with the d by dy symmetry. And more generally speaking, symmetry reduction gives a partial ordering on the set of integrable systems, and so you can at least understand your... if you're just interested in the general theory of integrable systems, you can understand them by symmetry reduction as relations between them. And maybe if you find a particularly big one, then you could maybe use that as a way of understanding all its descendants. And this, of course, led to a question, is there a universal integrable system? And I think the answer you can posit certain generalizations which give rise to all the ones you knew, then somebody will come along and give you another one which doesn't quite fit into that framework. And as they get bigger and bigger, they get more and more unwieldy and less satisfactory to deal with. So I think the point is it's probably not useful to really ask for a universal integrable system. But the self-Dugan-Mills equations are a pretty good place to start if you do want to classify reductions, and for many people you'll find most of the things that you want to play with in that list of reductions. Some people may not. And then the twister correspondences will reduce to give a correspondence for each of the systems you get by reduction. And so that will give you a starting point for understanding the theory of the reduced equations. Anyway, so this gave rise to a program then to understand sort of the taxonomy of reductions of the self-dual Yang-Mills equations and possibly also the self-dual Einstein equations, and then to derive the theory of those equations from the reduced twister correspondence. And so you can sort of talk about the ingredients you need to reduce. You can choose some reality structure. Are you starting in split signature or Euclidean signature? You can choose a gauge group. You can choose a symmetry subgroup of the conformal group in order to obtain the reduction. And you can also fix on the constants of integration that arise in the reduction. Now, at this point, I used to have a nice transparency with all your favorite integral systems, which I'd overlay on top of that. But just to give you an idea, just of a list of names, so if you start with self-dual Yang-Mills at the top, then in 2 plus 1 dimensions, or 3 dimensions, you will get things like just imposing one symmetry Bogomolny equations. And these can be on hyperbolic space or R3. And you also get certain chiral models that have some torsion. So they're ones that were developed by Manikoff and Zakharov, and also by Ward and Manikoff and so on. And then if you go down to 2 dimensions, you'll get really just the full list of your favorite equations, things like Stein-Gordon, chiral models, harmonic maps. Toda harmonic maps. And we'll get the Ernst equations from general relativity. So really a harmonic map from hyperbolic space rather than flat space. We get the KdV, nonlinear Schrodinger, and all of your favorite two-dimensional systems. I think there was only, there's only really one that was awkward to obtain in this way, which was the, I've forgotten its name. There's one that has an elliptic curve as its the spectral parameter lies on an elliptic curve. Landau Lifshitz, thank you. You could still do it, but only with a great deal of ugliness. If you go down, so that was two dimensions, or one plus one, then if you go down to one dimensions, again, you can get all of your favorite ODEs, so you can get all the Panleve equations and spinning tops and so on and so on. So, then there's a question, what's missing? Well, I think to a certain extent, if you want to restrict a finite dimensional gauge group, the KP equation was missing. That seems to... of course, the KP equation does not contain these Bogomolny equations, which are sort of, at least for a physicist, very interesting equations. But it does contain at least some of this end, the KdV and the Panleve, some of the Panleve's reductions. Okay, yeah. So you're already in a position where you have to actually extend things. So if you want to do the KdV hierarchy, then one ends up, in fact, it's most natural to introduce a Bogomolny hierarchy. And in fact, there are generalized self-UM Mills equations that descend to give the Bogomolny hierarchy. And these actually work very naturally. These work rather nicely with the twister theory. So the but you're right. You have to go outside of the self-UM Mills equations for those. Yeah. You have a but in some sense, in the twister correspondence, you're really just twisting it up a bit. So this here, you could always think of as a total space of a line of a vector bundle O1 plus O1 over CP1 if you take out the Linus infinity, and then you just twist those up. You go up to O n plus O n or something, and so it's a very natural extension to get the hierarchies, and they fit in very nicely. I just wanted to give one of the reductions in just a little bit more detail because it's a pretty story, and this is something that John was reminding me of on Monday night. So one of the most famous sets of integrable ODEs is the Panleve system, and these arose from this so-called Panleve property. So usually, if you have a solution to a nonlinear differential equation, then it can develop singularities that are, in some sense, arbitrarily bad. And generically, it will do so. So this is arbitrarily bad in the complex analysis sense. So there'll be essential singularities, or, in fact, most commonly, branching. And Panleve property, which John was reminding me, is really due to Sonia, was it Sofia Kovaleskaya, anyway, the condition that all the movable singularities, these are singularities which a solution just developed that's not at a singular point of the actual equation itself, should be rational. And this actually imposes strong conditions on the equation, and this is what led Kovaleskaya to find her integrable top. She imposed this condition, and that was what fixed the parameters for the integrable top that she discovered. So here there's just an example of just a very simple equation which has branching solutions generically, but for n equals 1 and 2 does not. Okay, so, and in fact, the n equals 2 case, I guess, is a special case of Riccati, which is also Panleve. There's been a long-standing conjecture that this Panleve property is actually a test for integrability, and Richard Ward showed in 1984 that the self-UEM Mills equations satisfy this property in some meaningful sense. The history here is that Panleve used this property to identify six equations So he classified all second-order equations with this Panleve property, and there were six that somehow could not be solved in terms of standard functions. And so this is the list here, and their solutions therefore define new transcendents, which somehow have some special property and are now, you know, on everyone's list of favorite special functions. So this is a slightly formidable list if you haven't seen it before. And so you might ask how this fits into the Self-Dual-Yang-Mills equations. And so one of the things you can do is you can say, well, I'm meant to get an integral equation whenever I do a symmetry reduction from four dimensions down to one. And so since these are, the Self-Dual-Yang-Mills equations give rise to a second-order system if you start with SL2C when you reduce. So presumably you just land on the Panleve equations. And that's what you discover. So you discover the Self-Dual-Yang-Mills with gauge group SL2C, and I've introduced the word non-degenerate abelian three-dimensional group of conformal symmetries yields the Panleve equations precisely. And in fact, there are five inequivalent symmetry groups you can choose, and that gives essentially the Panleve classification, except for the fact that P1 and P2 happen to arise from the same symmetry group. So this is a situation where it turns out that there's some constants of integration involved in the reduction, and there's an issue as to whether one of the constant matrices is nilpotent or semi-simple. So in the semi-simple case, it's P2, and in the nilpotent case, it's P1. So somehow you can see in this the kind of classification of the Panleve equations. And if you wanted to do third-order equations, maybe you'd start with a higher-rank gauge group. Okay, so at this point, I'm not quite sure what people are most interested in, but the thing that I've found sort of most uncomfortable about attending talks by the integrability people in this conference is that their techniques are so far from the ones that I'm used to dealing with. And so the techniques that naturally come out of the twister theory will be familiar to anyone who works with nonlinear integrable classical equations. And so I'll just say very briefly what those are. I've given a kind of a brief outline of how the twister correspondence works in this context. So twister space, I said, has these four homogeneous coordinates, Z alpha, and in order to write things out explicitly, we often just write them as omega and pi, where these are two component spinners, as I've said over there, and the correspondence with space-time is given via an instance relation where you set omega equals x pi, maybe with an I in there if you're worried about signatures. And what does that mean? That means that if you have a point x in space-time, pi is a... these are two coordinates here. This gives rise to a linear two-plane in C4, but in CP3, this is a line, LX. And so that was space-time. And a twister, then, so if you hold omega and pi constant, well, in the complex, this is two equations on X, and this will actually give rise to a totally null two-plane. If you're working in the reals, maybe Lorentz real, then all you can get is a real light ray for the intersection of that alpha plane with the real slice. So this is totally null and self-dual. And so you can set up the correspondence between solutions. So the Self-Dual-Yang-Mills equations and objects on twister space by So the CP1 here are really these pies that I've written down there. And so that pi is a homogeneous coordinates on a Riemann sphere. And then the V norm V1 that I've written up there, these are, of course, just... it could be expressed as a pair of vector fields in the spinner language, VA equals pi A prime DA A prime, and that's what spans the alpha plane. And so you can express twister spaces as quotients of M cross CP1 by those vector fields. And then for self-Turing-Mills, what you can do is you can lift the bundle from space-time with its connection up to here, so it's just covariant derivatives act trivially up the fibers. And then the point is that because the Lax pair is integrable, you can find simultaneous solutions to L naught S equals 0 and L1 S equals 0. So sections of the bundle can be found that are covariantly constants across along these alpha planes. And that just gives you a definition locally of a vector space at each point on twister space. And that's what you mean by a holomorphic vector bundle over twister space. Now, you might have thought you haven't done much. I mean, you defined a holomorphic vector bundle, or just a complex vector space at each point of twister space. But the remarkable result by Richard Ward is that given that holomorphic vector bundle, you can reconstruct the original self-Turing-Yang-Mills solution. And just to say a few brief words about this, a holomorphic vector bundle on twister space can be expressed in two different ways. There's probably many different ways. I mean, but there are two different ways as far as the sort of the general results are concerned. So one way is to usually we just work in a region in twister space. So I put a prime, just to say we're only working on some neighborhood of a line in twister space. And we can, you can either do it by patching functions. So we can cover PT prime by two open sets. Have U naught, U1. And the idea is that the bundle will be necessarily trivial on each of these open sets, but you can't make it trivial over the whole of twister space because there's some topology there. There are these CP1s, these Riemann spheres sitting inside the twister space. And so you introduce a patching function, which is a holomorphic function of Z. The intersection, and with values in GLNC, where GLNC is the gauge group. So this is free data for the bundle. The other thing you can do is give a D bar operator. So D bar plus A. And what we can do is we can actually make it depend only anti-holomorphically on the pi and pi bar. So it's going to be a holomorphic function of omega. So this is something you can generically do locally. And then d bar plus a will be equal to 0 just trivially from that. Sorry, this is pi bar d pi bar, say. So this gives you a formula for what turns out to be the general integrable d bar operator. So we can find the general holomorphic vector bundle then very easily in closed form in terms of free functions on twister space. But then, of course, you've got a challenge to reconstruct the corresponding solution on space-time. And if you want to do that, then that the principal task is to find the holomorphic trivialization of the bundle over each line. So first of all, there's a theorem that tells you that if the data is not too large, then the bundle will be trivial on all of these lines. And so this is sort of Grothendieck's classification of bundles on the Riemann sphere. And then you have to find the actual holomorphic trivialization. So in case one, for each LX, you must find H plus or minus X. Sorry, maybe I'll call it H naught X pi, H1 X pi, which would be holomorphic on U naught intersection LX, U1 intersection LX, respectively, such that P H naught equals H1. And this is what you mean by a global frame. In case two, we just have to solve D bar plus A. We have an HX, which is now a function of pi and pi bar. It can be have non-holomorphic dependence bar on each LX equals zero. And then in both cases, we can now reconstruct VA of H will be equal to H times pi A prime AX A prime. This will be once you've actually found the H here, you've got to all you need to do is differentiate it to find the original space-time connection that you're after. And so in one case you have this Riemann-Hilbert problem, and in the other case you've got a D-bar problem to solve. And one sees across the whole theory of classical integral systems these Riemann-Hilbert problems or D-bar problems playing. A role across the theory, and so this, from this point of view, this is where that theory is coming from. But what I'd like to be able to offer you is a coherent story as to how all these ideas can be quantized. Sitting in all of this structure here are the harmonic map equations, and amongst those harmonic map equations are harmonic maps into ADS5. And, of course, it doesn't take too much to impose the condition that the harmonic map is actually a minimal surface, and indeed even to extend it to ADS5 cross S5 and everything else. This is not work by me, but by lots of your friends here. One of the principal tasks of people here is to quantize that correspondence. From this point of view, then, it's really seeing how the quantization of the twister data in this sense can be quantized and give you meaningful information about the quantum solutions on space-time. And I should emphasize, though, that by the time we're talking about harmonic maps into ADS5 and so on and so on, these twisters here will have nothing to do with the sorts of twisters that have been playing a dominant role. This is a completely different side of the twister story. Yeah.
This one. So if instead of starting with self-dual Young mills, I started with self-dual n equals 4 super Young mills, and I tried to do the reduction down to, say, harmonic maps, say, into ADS5, is it possible I'd also find the right conditions for the type 2B string, so not just the you know, not just embedding the Riemann surface, but also the fermions?
Well, I don't know if doing it to CP... You see, these are more harmonic maps into a supersymmetric symmetric space. I mean, there is a lot of work on this, and I think I've certainly seen articles by, well, Berkowitz, Maldacena, Nicholas Beisers and co, and I think it goes back to maybe to Zeitlin and people in the 90s. I can't remember now. I mean, anyway, so I think obtaining the full supersymmetric correspondence is well known. Somebody here would be more expert and would be able to correct me. So, I just to maybe finish off a bit and lead on to the sort of thing that So I did want to make that distinction between the sorts of problems in integrability which people here have been addressing and the sorts that this has so far been geared up to address, so that we haven't done the quantum side. But just to say, to a certain extent, how this continues in the story of the last 8 years or so since Twister String Theory. The first thing that what one can observe is that here I was talking about just pure self-dual Yang-Mills, and that in itself is not really a theory in the normal sense. I mean, that there are actions for self-dual Yang-Mills, but they all break Lorentz invariants. But there is a self-dual sector of full Yang-Mills. And So if you want a self-dual sector of full Yang-Mills, then you have your connection. On space-time now, you have your connection at AAA prime, and then you have some auxiliary two-form, self-dual two-form. Yeah. Other G two-form, self-dual two-form. So maybe I'll call it anti-self-dual because I've already messed up my conventions. And we can ask that these are both values in the Lie algebra, and we can write down the equation. If A is self-dual, then of course we'll have the F minus equals zero. But we can also require that dA G equals zero, and there's a nice equation for that integral G. Wedge F, which is the action. And then you can add on, you can extend it to the full Yang-Mills action just by adding on an extra term. And this is the Chalmers and Siegel full Yang-Mills action. Now, in this case, if you add on a n equals 4 Suzy completion, well, this will then give rise to holomorphic Chern-Simons theory on twister space. Because this will still correspond to a holomorphic vector bundle, but this is now on a supersymmetric twister space where you have four additional anti-commuting variables. Again here, we can now see that this self-dual sector is an integrable sector of the self-dual Yang-Mills equations. And then you can... but one of the points is it's actually this is integrable, and we can actually see what the perturbation is to perturb around that sector, and really, what the consequence of the work of the last 8 years is that we've figured out how to actually include these extra interaction terms. So these complete the self-dual sector. That's why this is meant to be self-dual. Self-dual sectors of the full theory. And again, this has a supersymmetric completion. And so we've figured out how to express that extra term on twister space, but we were using the integrability of the self-dual sector to essentially trivialize that's part of the equation. And because these equations are nonlinear on space-time, they already lead to considerable complication in the space-time formulations of the theory. On twister space, it can be trivialized in the sort of way that I was describing, and then you're dealing with many fewer interactions, which are somehow much easier to handle, at least perturbatively. And so that's some explanation, at least, for the direction in which we've been taking this integrability story in the last 6 years, that the self-dual sector is... there's a great advantage in trivializing the self-dual sector on twister space and then expanding around that, and that reduces the complexity of the formula you get, so the number of Feynman diagrams. But hopefully at some point we'll learn how to do things properly, non-perturbatively, and even there one might hope also that, that there's some simplification arising from this point of view. Anyway, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Yes, okay, let's start with.
Just a comment, which is, I mean, this goes back to prehistory. The quantum version of the inverse scattering transform in its early days was essentially the algebraic beta ansatz. And so it's the algebraic version of the beta ansatz, which is the quantum equivalent of the integrability methods.
And there's also the Fadiev school as well, that developed the... So the quantum version, I guess, was a more discrete version. That was a discretized...
No, it's just all of the Lax matrices have quantum analogs. Yeah. And the algebraic version of the beta ansatz just consists... I mean, you build up this monodromy matrix and all that. You just build it up out of the quantum version of the Lax matrix, which are operators. And they give a representation of the Yangian or whatever model you're looking at, and it really is, in some sense, just the quantum version of the inverse scattering method. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Sort of an interpretation of what the quantum version, as far as eigenstates are concerned, for dynamics.
I think it should be a very elementary question, but I was wondering how each in system fit in this reduction scheme that you presented.
So So in fact, the Hitchin system was discovered in this way. Nigel was really just looking at the Euclidean signature reduction. So the harmonic map is a reduction from split signature of self-dual Yamhills, and so then you get maps to the gauge group, essentially, or some symmetric space. And then the Hitchin system is when you start from Euclidean signature. And instead of getting maps to the gauge group, if you want to think of it as a harmonic map, you get maps to the complexified gauge group divided by the gauge group. So you get this homogeneous space which is hyperbolic. It has negative curvature and it has much better behavior. But then he discovered it had this amazing conformal symmetry, which was which is not something that one expected, and so you could actually put it on an arbitrary Riemann surface. And this is actually a remarkable feature of many of the reductions that they have unexpectedly large symmetry groups when you reduce them. The KDB equation, for example, when you get down to that, has an infinite dimensional, the actual reduced Sufjan-Mills equations have an infinite dimensional symmetry group, which then needs to be fixed in order to identify the KDB equation. So this turns out to be part of a wider pattern in the symmetry reductions.
So if there are no further questions, let's thank Lionel again. And